From WXXI News in Rochester, New York, IdeaStream in Cleveland, Ohio, and Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland, Oregon, this is a special multi-state talk show focusing on the opioid crisis in America. I'm your host, Evan Dawson. The Centers for Disease Control reports that opioid deaths have increased dramatically in the past two decades, and the biggest increase in overdose deaths has happened in just the past 3 years. Today, 115 people will die in this country from an opioid overdose. The growth in the use of prescription painkillers has raised questions about how we tolerate and manage pain, about opioid dependency versus addiction, and about alternative forms of treatment. This hour, we'll welcome guests from all three cities and states, but first, we want to get a snapshot of the latest on the opioid crisis in all three states. So we're going to start in Portland with Sarah Rothenfletch. And Sarah, good afternoon here. Good morning to you in Portland.
Good morning, Evan. Thank you so much. You know, it's really interesting here in Oregon. Back in 2012, the state led the nation in terms of non-medical use of opioids. Of course, we're still one of the highest in terms of the percentage of people getting an opioid prescription, but the state's doing something right, I'm really pleased to say. Opioid-assisted overdoses have dropped 20% from their peak a couple of years ago. In a nutshell, what's happened is the state has taken the CDC's prescription guidelines to heart and has really looked at how to prevent overdoses, prevent opioid crisis. Oregon set up a task force to really push new guidelines. They push clinics and hospitals to change their prescribing practices, push doctors to incorporate pain management into their continuing education efforts, and emphasize the use of prescription drug monitoring. There's a website in which doctors can trace the use of opioids, not just here in Oregon, but across the river into Washington as well. And of course, doctors have also worked hard to provide people who are suffering from long-term chronic pain with lots of alternative ways of managing that. Acupuncture, physical therapy, eating healthy, even a fascinating thing with virtual reality. The big struggle, of course, now is to get insurance companies to cover those alternative therapies. And so we are taking steps here to really work with this crisis and hopefully move things forward for the country.
All right, Sarah, thank you very much. Let's go to Cleveland now with IdeaStream reporter Marlene Harris-Taylor. Welcome to you, Marlene.
Hi, Evan. Evan, I'm afraid in Ohio there's still quite a bit of bad news to share on the opioid crisis because it really has ravaged the state. At one point, Ohio was number one in drug overdoses, but we still have one of the highest rates in the country. We're second only to West Virginia. And communities across the state are struggling with resources. The governments are struggling. Medical examiners' offices are struggling with overcrowding in the morgues. In some communities, they're having to bring in trailers to store bodies. And of course, the human cost is just unconscionable. There's still 11 people a day dying from drug overdoses in Ohio, and there's no signs that the crisis has hit its peak. That's what we're hearing from state officials. And pain pills, heroin, and cocaine are being laced with a powerful synthetic opioid called fentanyl. And fentanyl is 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine. And Evan, right now, that's what's fueling the crisis in Ohio. In fact, the Ohio Department of Health took the step to put out an advisory about fentanyl because last year in 2017, 71% of all unintentional drug overdose deaths involved fentanyl or fentanyl analogs in the state. So some people say it's no longer a heroin crisis in Ohio. It's now a fentanyl crisis in Ohio. Mm. First responders report that they're using record amounts of that reversal drug, naloxone. But we all know that's only a Band-Aid that lets, you know, people go on for another day. Now, on the good side, on the positive side, solution side, state officials have taken some steps to curb the number of prescription opioid pills, similar, you know, to what we just heard about in Oregon. And, you know, so they're keeping the doctor's offices and the hospitals from giving them out. And that's stopping people from getting addicted on the front end, right, and stopping that cycle. And I'm also hearing from some of our reporters who are working on stories for this week that there are pockets, there are some communities where money is starting to flow. So access to treatment and access to detox beds is becoming more available now, but it depends on where you live in the state. In some rural communities, it's still very hard to get access to treatment. But if you live in some more urban areas, you have a better chance of getting into treatment if you want it.
Well, Marlene, thank you. Marlene Harris-Taylor, reporter with Cleveland's Idea Stream. And now I'll provide a brief look at what's happening in Western New York. The surge in heroin and opioid deaths here happened in 2016 when more than 200 people died, up from around 80 the year before. The average age of overdose death here is 36, but it ranges from the teens to 76. So heroin is a huge problem, but so is opioid addiction in patients who were simply trying to manage pain. And our county executive has appointed a physician's council to offer a medical approach to the crisis. That involves re-educating the public about our expectations for managing pain. In other words, opioids will be available in cases of acute pain, but doctors would like to start moving patients to other treatments. That's going to be difficult for existing patients who have to rely on opioids, and it's a challenge for a public that has been told for years that they can expect to live without pain. That's where we're going to start the conversation with doctors in all three studios and cities. Let's start with Dr. Crawford Barnett, an expert in pain management. He's a physician in the Department of Pain Management at the Cleveland Clinic and clinical assistant professor in the Department of Anesthesiology at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine at Case Western University. Dr. Barnett, welcome. In this hour, we're looking forward, and I wonder if you could create a systemic shift in pain management, change everything essentially from scratch. How often would opioids be prescribed, if at all, and what would change?
Thanks, Evan. I think that one of the key aspects in answering this question is to start by looking at what treatments can be effective over the long term in not only managing or modulating a patient's pain, but also improving their overall functioning and quality of life. With that being said, as far as opiates themselves go, while they can be appropriate or may be appropriate for acute pain, such as due to significant injury or surgery, contemporary evidence, unfortunately, doesn't support the efficacy of these medications for chronic pain. This was reflected in a JAMA article, the Journal of the American Medical Association, that just came out recently, as well as other research that's been done over previous years. Not only is there specifically the issue of addiction and dependence, which is the thrust of the whole crisis that we're addressing, but also when you look at these medications, you have to answer the question, are they actually helping the patient? When you take an opiate, tolerance build is the first thing that starts to happen. We can absolutely control a patient's pain for a snapshot in time, but the actual benefit is more like being on a treadmill. You're walking the exact same spot or taking the exact same amount of medication just to stay in that same spot over the floor. With a medication, it's analogous to somebody turning the speed up on the treadmill. Now you need to take more, now you need to walk faster just to stay in the same spot, and this rolls out to higher and higher doses of medication. When you start to analyze how patients benefit or don't benefit from this, patients' function actually starts to decrease. Their depression can start to increase, hormone axes shift, and actually when you start looking at this, there's a phenomenon called opiate-induced hyperalgesia in which the pain fibers become sensitized to the medication and actually the pain gets worse. So then if opiates have a limited long-term efficacy, and may well, in fact, do more harm than good, what do we do from here? And the question is, unfortunately, there's not a magic bullet. Although 20 years ago, some of the pharmacy companies tried to use their medications as this magic bullet, we'd guarantee there's no pain, your life's going to be wonderful. The reality is it's much more complex than that. And to address what is a very real issue with multiple patients who have chronic pain, we have to take a multifaceted approach to this.
And Dr. Barnett, let me just jump in real quickly here.
Yes.
Because I'm going to be up against the break at one point here. But let me just ask you, and then we will revisit this as we go throughout the hour. In that ideal world that you would envision with pain management,
right,
opioids would be prescribable only in the case of what and for how long?
I think for acute injury and acute recovery is where they really shine. Long term, we need to look at other things, including physical therapy, non-opiate medications, pain psychology, cognitive behavioral therapy, and then procedures or surgery when they may be warranted.
Okay, so maybe 4 to 6 weeks of a prescription of opioids, and that's it.
Yes, but even then, it's not always appropriate. It's for a significant injury or for a significant region. It still shouldn't be handed out just as a matter of course. I tweaked my knee, so now I should get a 90-day supply or a 30-day supply of medicines. It still needs to be used, you know, in a very discerning fashion.
I promise we're going to stay on this subject as we go throughout the hour. I want to go over to Portland, where Dr. Alicia Moreland-Kapuya is the executive director of the Avil Gordley Center for Healing and a professor of psychiatry in the School of Medicine at Oregon Health and Science University. Dr. Moreland-Kapuya, are we focusing too narrowly on opioids or pain management or any one specific thing here?
Yeah, I would have to say that I tend to agree with the colleague who just spoke prior that the issue of opioid use disorders in all substance use disorders has to be more multifaceted. And I'll say this. Currently, right now, the question is about pain. What I've often asked about is, are we focusing on the right pain? Oftentimes, we talk about physical pain and we forget the larger sort of subtext, which is there is a deep emotional pain that I don't think that we have been able to effectively address in this country. And let me give the case in point. Back in early in the 1960s and 1970s, African Americans and people of color were disproportionately impacted by opioids, and it was deemed a crisis at that time. And during that time, the focus was more on reinforcement, and resources were put more on reinforcement as opposed to rehabilitation. So essentially what you had is a public safety focus. And then we kind of shift forward to the 1990s when OxyContin actually came on board. Pharmaceutical companies placed it, and it was disproportionately prescribed to a wider, more affluent community. Because at the time, also, physicians and healthcare providers did not think that African Americans had pain, and in many instances, there were preconceived notions about African Americans and people of color being addicts already. And then when that issue of OxyContin and prescribed opioids became greater in the areas of physical dependence and addiction, it was, oh my goodness, we have to do something about it. So effectively, the demographic from the 1960s and 70s shifted in the early 21st century to a more wider contingent. And at that time, the shift became from public safety to public health.
It's a problem with the white face.
It is, and I will reframe that in saying that the shift considerably took place when it impacted a wider WITER and wider WIDER community.
And Dr. Moreland, let me just jump in because we've got to hit our first break. We're going to continue on this point when we come right back. You're going to hear the medical perspective from Rochester. We're going to hear from patients as well as we broadcast in Rochester, Cleveland, and Portland, Oregon in this special conversation. Welcome back. Good afternoon in the East. Good morning on the West Coast. We're broadcasting from WXXI News in Rochester, New York, IdeaStream in Cleveland, Ohio, and from Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland, Oregon. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking opioids, and I had to briefly interrupt. I want to turn back to Dr. Alicia Moreland-Kapuya to kind of finish that thought as we discuss how we understand this crisis. Go ahead, Doctor.
Yeah, and as I was explaining, is that there was an effective shift to a public health frame, which I do agree that's the direction that we need to go into education, prevention, and treatment. And in thinking about this, though, getting back to the issue of opioids, right now it has been focused on opioids, which is important because we have experienced a number of deaths. But if we look at the data from the National Institutes of Drug Abuse from 2000 to 2016, what we see is there's also been a marked increase in deaths related to cocaine and methamphetamine use as well. And so I would contend that we don't just have an opioid use disorder issue, we have an addiction problem in America. And effectively, what we have to do is to address that addiction issue. And I would reframe the discussion in this particular way. when we think about addiction and we think about pain, it's not just physical pain, but it's deep emotional pain. And the argument that I would make is one that really Maslow made back in 1948 with his hierarchy of needs. He essentially says that at the bottom of the base of this triangle, that there are basic needs like food, water. Above that is security, financial and physical. Above that is love and belongingness. And he essentially argues that in order for you to reach the peak of self-actualization, that basic needs have to be met. In this country, there is deep emotional pain that has not been addressed, and it is intimately attached to persistent unmet need. And until we get to a place that where we, as a society, can meet those needs, we will continue to see substance use disorders and addiction as a persistent issue.
Let's turn here in Rochester. Dr. Timothy Wiegand is in studio with us here. He's the director of toxicology at the University of Rochester Medical Center and medical director of Huther Doyle Chemical Dependency Treatment Program. Dr. Wiegand, one of the, I don't know if it's controversial, but at least there's a lot of debate about using opioids to treat opioids. And you hear about Suboxone. I think Suboxone is what we know it as. It's buprenorphine. How much should we see prevalence of opioids treating opioids? Is it safe? What do you expect to see of that in the future?
Thank you, Evan. You know, I agree that we're in the crisis or an epidemic of addiction. It's not just simply related to opioids. The addictive substances, psychoactive substances use is increasing all across, whether it's THC, cocaine, stimulants, sedatives, benzodiazepines, and opioids in particular. I came to this as a medical toxicologist, as a physician who takes care of poisoning and poison patients at the bedside, so seeing an awful lot of the casualties of the toxic effects of these substances in the emergency department and in the hospital setting. From there, I later developed an addiction medicine skill set, became certified in addiction medicine, and brought my practice from the hospital, from the ED, into the clinic and into the focus of preventing the overdoses and preventing the complications that we saw with patients as they got into trouble with chemicals and drugs. One of the treatments that has been particularly effective has been buprenorphine, better known as Suboxone, an opioid, but a unique type of opioid. The consult service that I take care of patients in the hospital now, a large portion of the visits in the ED in the hospital setting are not just related to overdose from toxicity, but patients coming in on medication-assisted treatment now, buprenorphine, and managing pain, managing the buprenorphine or Suboxone before surgery, after surgery, helping them get through the hospital stay. And I've seen patients do remarkably well, not just with regards to not using opioids, but also with regards to their pain. Buprenorphine is a unique opioid. When we talk about opioids, we usually mean the opioid and its activity at something called the mu receptor. The mu receptor is responsible for the analgesia, also for the euphoria. But buprenorphine does some other things as well. And it interacts in that receptor in a relatively unique way, one that makes it less toxic, but particularly effective for analgesia. It has a different effect in another receptor that modifies some of this tolerance that we heard is quite a problem with the other opioids from some of our other speakers, and potentially can mitigate even the effect, the hyperalgesia or the increase in pain that we see with patients taking chronic opioids. But to dose appropriately for pain, as well as treat somebody with a substance use disorder, some people need to, the physicians, providers need to understand the pharmacology, need to dose it a little bit differently than they use for the treatment of opiate dependence, and understand it's also its interaction in relation to other medications. I think as we try to dig ourselves out of this and look for replacements, we look to different types of opioids, looking at some of these other receptors, potentially leveraging buprenorphine or Suboxone and its effect on analgesia. And not just in patients with addiction. There's actually preparations that are indicated of buprenorphine as a patch, as a sublingual or buccal formulation for pain only, so that you wouldn't use for the treatment of opiate dependence. So less toxic, some unique effects, some exploration in pharmacology to try and find other drugs that may be able to have these effects without the toxicity. And increasing education in addiction and pharmacology in general. I think that's how we dig our way out of this and look for solutions.
All right, that's three medical perspectives in three cities. And what we're going to do now is bring in the voices of some patients And then for the rest of the hour, the doctors in these three cities will have a chance to respond to this. And what we're hearing, let me read a couple of emails, one from Cleveland, one from Rochester, and then you're going to hear from some patients here with us. Alex in Cleveland says, please don't forget those of us who live with severe chronic pain and are being forced to suffer due to new restrictions. I was told by doctors to go into hospice because then at least I would get 6 good months. Many people are choosing hospice because they can't get relief from their very painful conditions. Even more are forced to leave the workforce since their doses have been reduced or eliminated. No one is talking about what this is doing to us. That's Alex in Cleveland. Benjamin in Rochester served in the armed forces in the 1990s. He had to carry heavy equipment. He says, very short amount of time, but the compression on my spine was incredible, and it did a lot of damage. My cervical spine is an absolute mess. With that comes nerve pain, which, I can tell you, feels as though I am burning to death from the inside. It is truly an evil, insidious pain that is relentless. And that leaves opiates. They are a joyous, albeit mild, relief for me. I have never abused them in all the years I took them. When I choose to come off, and they stop working as your body becomes immune, I simply taper down, and while no fun, I am no worse for the wear. He says, people need to understand that there is a need for these medications or make medical marijuana easier to get. I've never had it, but I've heard positive things. Those are from a couple of patients, one in Cleveland, one in Rochester. Laura Garrison is with us in studio here. She's actually vice president for development at WXXI, one of our colleagues, and she's a patient who has lived with long-term chronic pain since when? What's your pain story?
So I think that I've lived with pain most of my life. When I was in high school, I had problems with my knees and everything. And it sort of turned out that as time went on, I discovered that what I had was something that's called inflammatory arthritis, which is my understanding, something slightly less than rheumatoid arthritis, but still very serious. My joints are deteriorating. And in the early 90s, I started to go on medication and try to come up with some ways to stop the pain. In 2001, I had my first hip replacement. In 2003, I had my second hip replacement. And in 2012, I had my third hip replacement. So I've also had several knee surgeries, several shoulder surgeries, all kinds of different things, mostly to try and stop the arthritis. It's now turned into fibromyalgia, which I understand is another common thing to happen. And I'm hearing good news. Eventually, I'm going to get to the point where, you know, all of my joints are tingling and everything. My hands are already to that stage at night. So I live with pain on a regular basis, but it's sort of something that I've gotten used to. It's not a good thing to say, but it's true. And I'm tired all the time. There are things I simply can't do. I can certainly come to work. I can certainly function. I can certainly have a great time. But by the time I get home at night, I'm done. So consequently, I don't exercise. Consequently, I weigh more than I really should. And consequently, that's bad for all of my joints. So what I'm trying to do is work with my doctors to come up with a program that incorporates a lot of different things. I do acupuncture. I do myofascial release with a physical therapist. I do yoga. I do tons and tons of Tylenol, tons and tons of anti-inflammatories. I take Plaquenil to stop some of the problems with my joints. And all of that is effective. But sometimes the pain gets out of control, and I find that opioids are the best way to relieve that pain in an instant fashion.
How often?
Sometimes once every 4 or 5 months. Sometimes it's once a week. It just depends.
Okay, so it's not daily for you.
It's not daily. It just comes and goes. And I use that as a last resort. Certainly, I'm not going to start with an opioid when I'm in pain. And a lot of times, like I said, it's just when I'm in really serious acute pain. And having gone to a pain clinic here in Rochester, one of the things they tell you is stay ahead of the pain. Make sure that you can keep it under control. And when it gets out of control, you got to do what you got to do in order to get it back in control. So I take the opioids.
Are you finding yourself relating to the emails that I read? Are you nervous about losing this as an option?
Well, I'm not, because I have really wonderful doctors who understand that that is part of my medication and have gotten to know me over the years and understand that I'm not abusing it. Prior to my first hip surgery, I was taking Vicodin like it was candy. I think I took 20 or 30 pills a day sometimes. And I was very nervous I was going to become addicted. I had my hip surgery, and I kept on saying, what happens if I'm addicted? And I wasn't. So I often it's very interesting to me to see what addiction is and it isn't, because I don't seem to become addicted to it even when I'm taking massive doses of it. Now, I have to tell you, it really wasn't very effective. It really wasn't stopping the pain. And so consequently, before my second hip surgery, I just didn't even bother because it wasn't worth it. Just live with the pain.
Is there a stigma? Do you fear
a
stigma?
You bet.
There's a stigma with opioids?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it just so happens that Evan and I were traveling to Spain, and I took some opioids. And several people on the bus said, you took opioids? Why are you taking opioids? And it's not that I'm addicted. It's just that I was doing like probably triple or four times the amount of walking and physical activity that I normally do, and I hurt.
It was a work trip.
We
can report that. Let's turn to another patient. This is in Portland. Michelle Maricos is a patient living with chronic pain she's also a certified peer support specialist for chronic pain. She works with Oregon Pain Guidance. And I want to go back, I guess it was 15, 16 years ago, Michelle. Why don't you tell us what happened to you and what changed your life?
Yes. Hi, Evan. Thank you so much for having
me.
So 15 years ago in 2003, I had a very bad accident and crushed 3 vertebrae in my neck. And so I kind of started down the road of opioids. The doctors said, okay, well, we're not going to do surgery. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to do, you know, medication. And so I lived on medication for a long time. And then in about 2011, I ended up having some problems with my discs in my neck and had a surgery. And unfortunately, that surgery failed. So I was left in bed on high-dose opioids and pretty much non-functional. So I was at the point of having another surgery, a full cervical fusion, and I was told I couldn't have the surgery because I was on such high-dose opioids. So then I went back to my doctor, said, okay, well, you know, I can't have the surgery until I taper down. And his response was, well, did they tell you how to do that? So I kind of was at this point of, I need, you know, a large hospital system. I need some kind of large intervention. And so I went to the Mayo Clinic. And the Mayo Clinic said, yes, we'll do the surgery, but again, you cannot be on these high-dose opioids. But we do have a program. It's called the Pain Rehabilitation Program, Pain Rehabilitation Clinic. And go to that program, do that program, and call us when you're done. So that program, it saved my life. It truly did. It was a 3-week program, tapering off of the medication, learning about pain, learning about the pain cycle, learning about trauma and addiction versus dependence. And so I was highly dependent on that medication. And being able to get off of that medication and move on with my life and have some life skills that I really could grasp onto that was not the pain medication made the huge difference.
And so now, tell me about the work that you do with other patients, because what you're hearing from other patients who have already written the program today, Michelle, is a fear. A fear of, I've talked to people in my own family in Cleveland, that's where I'm from, who are concerned about what happens if you lose this as an option, or I can't, you know, live without certain medications, certain opioid prescriptions.
So after I ended up coming back from the Mayo Clinic, I ended up being able to work with a group called the Oregon Prescribers Group, and now it's Oregon Pain Guidance Group. And that group is a group of doctors and kind of concerned citizens. And I ended up doing a peer support specialty training to learn how to work with patients and to learn how to, you know, field those questions of the fear that it is, you know, fear and anger, and that anger is based in fear because it is the unknowing question of what will I feel like if I don't have this medication. And being in that place and being able to help other patients through that place of, okay, we're going to get you the skills and all of the information that you need to be able to live your life on lower doses of medication, not necessarily off of medication, but just lower, safer doses that are reasonable.
And do you think, Michelle, that there has to be a continuing conversation about expectations? In other words, in the last 20, 25 years, when we made pain a vital sign, when we started asking in hospitals about, you know, your pain on a 1 to 10 scale, did we then create this expectation that we will wipe out all of your pain, and if we don't, there's something wrong?
Yes, because there's a misconception of the cure. And I spent years of my life looking for the cure for chronic pain. I never once heard until I got to the Mayo Clinic that there's no cure for chronic pain. And that was a devastating point, but it got me to a point of acceptance of, okay, there's no cure, but I can actually accept living with the pain and having those expectations of get to a place of with your life of living with a certain amount of pain, and that that's okay. And that learning about the medication, too, and that how it does cause more pain the higher doses that you get into, and that hyperanalgesia actually creates more pain, kind of was a motivator to actually get off the medication also.
All right, I'm looking at the clock. We've got about 2.5 minutes to our next break, and what we're going to do after the break is turn back to the doctors in our various studios in Portland, Cleveland, and Rochester for their response to what they're hearing from patients in all three cities. I want to turn back to Laura Garrison, who's a patient here. And, you know, you're hearing from Michelle, who went through a lot. I mean, just hellacious pain herself. And she's saying she's working with people, probably people who have been in situations like yours. Are you persuaded?
Well, absolutely, because that's how it is. You have to understand that when you have a chronic condition, you're going to be in pain. That's just how life is. So the question is what can you do to alleviate the pain? What can you do to get to a point where you can live a, and I'm putting this in quotation marks, normal life and still manage your pain? Because that's what it is. It's the management of the pain. And hopefully you've got some really great doctors who are able to help you through it and who prescribe or who are willing to prescribe alternative therapies. My rheumatologist happens to be from Africa. He was trained in Africa. I always like to think that that makes him open to a lot of different things. You know, here in Rochester, we don't have the chance to try marijuana. I'd love to try it. They're not convinced here in Rochester. But, you know, perhaps someday they will be. And maybe there are other things that you can do. So I'm always looking for next things. And I'm not even going to get into the insurance issues with paying for those alternative therapies because they simply don't for the most part. You know, even with a prescription, they may pay for a quarter, a third, a half of those therapies so that you have to be living at a certain level with a certain income just to even to provide those therapies for patients out there. Having opioids as part of the mix is an important thing to me, and I bet it is to a lot of people. But it's certainly not the only answer, and it shouldn't be your first answer.
Against my better judgment, I'm going to say the number for this talk show in three cities. And if the phone goes nuts, what we need to do is this. Whether you're in Portland, Cleveland, or Rochester, understand that your local public radio is continuing this discussion on its various platforms. And if you can't get through to the program today, please stay in touch with IdeaStream Cleveland, OPB in Portland, WXXI in Rochester on these platforms, whether it's talk shows like we do in Rochester or in different reporting. Different social media, because these doctors are here. They're going to want to continue these discussions, and there's a lot of important points being made here. But if you want to call the program, we'll try to squeeze it in. I'm thinking about people like Bill in Portland who called earlier, wanted to talk medical marijuana. 844-295-TALK is the number. 844-295-8255. You can do that here, and we're going to try to get through as many of your comments as we can before the end of this hour. If you're just joining us, whether you are in Portland, Cleveland, or Rochester, we're having a conversation across three cities, and I'm Evan Dawson, Public Radio, bringing you a discussion on opioids, the ripple effect, pain management, our expectations, and more. This is our last break, and we're right back with you next. Welcome back. Hey, Cleveland and Portland, should we do this once a week? 12 phone lines just lit up at once. We're going to try to get through as much as we can. Let's hear from the doctors who are in studio, and let me go back to Cleveland. This is Dr. Crawford Barnett, who is an expert in pain management. Dr. Barnett, you've been listening to patients share their perspectives, and I want to get a sense from you on what you would say to patients like Benjamin in Rochester, who wrote in saying, you know, he had these military-related spinal compression. He doesn't think that he would have a quality of life worth living all these years without opioids. How do we work with that? What's your approach with them?
I think, first of all, it needs to absolutely be recognized that this is a very real patient with a very real condition. Although the whole opiate crisis, you know, has very negative downstream connotations, these patients should not feel the stigma of either having been on the medications or having the discussion with whomever their physician is about getting them or getting alternative treatments. I think that Michelle Marcos made an excellent point that one of the things that we need to do is deal with the fear, the anger when somebody is talking about, hey, we want to consider other options. Opiates may not be the optimal thing, and I think there this discussion has to be done in a very real but very sensitive fashion because these are patients and they are in pain. That is without question. And it's a stepwise approach. There are other options, and some people have done some of them. Some people have done all of them. Most have not had somebody try and tailor it specifically to them. And I think the key thing is first having a discussion that there are alternatives. I've had numerous patients through the years that we have gotten them off of medications, opiates specifically, and looked at other pathways. It sounds simplistic, but I can't emphasize or overemphasize the importance of physical therapy and activity as part of it. It's not the answer. There's not a panacea here, but it is one step in moving forward. We have other options as well. Cognitive behavioral therapy is one of the absolute best things that can be done. The downside of these two modalities is insurance is loving not to pay for things. It's much easier to pay for a quick pill. It's much less effort on everybody's part. But with the president's commission to attack opiate addiction or the opiate epidemic, they are, or at least in their initial paperwork, are going to try and leverage these modalities as part of the patient's treatment.
And doctor,
yes.
And so let me just follow up because I'm imagining all the patients who feel like they never have enough time with their doctor.
Right.
That frustration that you barely get any FaceTime.
Yes.
And what you're talking about is shifting away, and I don't want to throw out a number out of speculation, but my guess is in the next 5-10 years, if we're successful, we're going to see opioids prescribed significantly less often. Not eliminated, as you said, but significantly less often.
Correct.
That probably means a much, I don't want to say more difficult, but a more time-sensitive approach for patients who are concerned about pain. And then the arduous amount of time to figure out, well, this works for one patient, it doesn't work for the next, it might not work for the next, that is more time, right? And so what do you say to patients who feel like, you're going to tailor a pain approach to me, why don't you just give me the pills?
Absolutely. And this is a process. I'm not going to, in one 30-minute consultation, cure a patient. As much as I would love to be able to do so, and as much as occasionally you can, quite often these people have been dealing with patients for 1, 3, 5, 10, even 20 or 30 years. And just as it's taken them time to get to where they are, we have to take the time to get them into a different place. And so, yes, we're going to do this in bite-sized chunks, and we're going to try one thing, and I'm going to see them again moving forward. We're going to try another, and we're going to gradually, if humanly possible, get the patient to a better place. There is absolutely not a one-size-fits-all, but if you try and approach it as what seems to be necessary per patient and as it you find what works, what doesn't, and you keep moving forward, quite often we get dramatic success with patients without opiates and without high doses of opiates.
So there are success stories, and let's go back to Portland here. By the way, if you're on the phone waiting to get through, I see immediately that OPB is not just Portland. OPB is, of course, a statewide public radio station, and we appreciate that. Heather in Vancouver, Washington, we're going to try to get to you in a moment, just as WXXI here in Rochester, our partner station, WUS, across the Finger Lakes. So public radio everywhere, Ohio, Portland, and all across Oregon, here in Western New York. We're proud to be doing this program today. And let's go back to Portland, where Dr. Alicia Moreland Capuya has been listening. What stands out to you when it comes to either the concern that patients are expressing or these alternative ideas that that feel like, you know, in some ways should be pretty accessible, but systemic change is hard to come by, doctor? What would you say?
Yeah, I would say that here in Oregon, we actually have moved forward in the area and the arena of team-based care, because you're absolutely right. One physician appointment isn't going to suffice in terms of helping to manage a very complex issue. And so it is, at the very beginning, what it could potentially look like is the patient meets with a team of folks. And so now that they have a team that consists of, a medical assistant, a physician, a peer mentor, and a social worker, who all are working on behalf of helping to really help the patient navigate this pain journey. And I think that the two patients who've shared their stories on here today have really highlighted some very important points. One is this idea that pain is something that will not necessarily go away, but it's something that we have to find ways to sort of peaceably coexist with. So it's the reality that life is painless in some areas and painful in others, and finding ways to effectively navigate that space. And the medical healthcare system has to adapt to both manage and help to modulate the treatment responses to pain. And lastly, I'll say the other piece, it's very interesting because I think that the discussion has to be reframed. It's sort of like Linus, the pain story is sort of like Linus and his blanket. If you take that blanket away from Linus, he's left naked and shivering and ashamed. But the discussion shouldn't be about taking away the blanket as much as it is finding ways to replace that blanket and make that blanket more safe and secure. And what we do know from studies is that there are, and I don't even want to use the word alternative, there are safer means and more productive, effective means in the long term of managing pain. And what we've got to do a better job of as physicians is both educating and guiding and partnering with patients to help them explore that reality.
Before the program began, Dr. Timothy Wiegand here in Rochester told me that there's a difference between pain and suffering, and the understanding that is important. How does that factor into this discussion, Doctor?
Well, that's right, Evan. I heard a lot of great ideas, and I also heard a lot of the patients express frustration. They're frustrated not just because it's a struggle to get good pain control, but it's also a frustration that they're suffering. And to appropriately approach both, we heard that we need to set expectations appropriately, certainly setting expectations that it's not reasonable to be completely pain-free. A little bit of pain is, in some cases, okay. It tells us when things potentially need to be changed. It's one of the reasons we actually survive as a species, as humans in this world. The best way of approaching pain isn't a one-size-fits-all with everything. It's a multimodal approach. We heard some descriptions of exercise, of mindfulness, of yoga, of medications, but not just opioids, of other medications. The challenges in putting this approach together for patients is access to the specialists that are skilled in this area, the cost, the coverage, the insurance coverage for all of these type of therapies, and access to the programs that are able to do these therapies, and the skill and the resources that can be leveraged, not just for patients, but to collaborate among health professionals.
Who's going to change insurance? I mean, you're right when you say there are patients who are running into this. Well, you could try physical therapy. You can try something else, but insurance might not cover it. Well, you probably want what the insurance is going to cover. What's going to change that, Tim?
I think that's challenging. I think the evidence-based, as it's changed and shows that certain things work better than others or that they don't work, that will change insurance. And we have to show that it's less expensive to treat patients, to keep them out of the emergency department and out of the hospital. And we do so not by giving them opioids, but by keeping them healthy. And by keeping them healthy, we focus on diet, on nutrition, on exercise, on access to the right care therapies and cares, and to support them better in their community and their home. And that, while is a little bit of outlay at the front, it certainly is less of an outlay over the course of one's life. It keeps people working. It keeps people healthy and their families and functioning. And that's really the goal. We want to keep people functioning. I think, we've lost the approach to what is going to keep somebody healthy, happy and functioning, rather than what's going to close this visit quickly, get them out of the ED, get them out of the hospital, get them out of the clinic, satisfy them so they don't call me over the weekend, and it just keeps them kind of numb at home. And that's unfortunately what opioids do in a lot of the cases. So I think as we leverage all of that and get the evidence base to support that, that's what I'd hope.
If I come to you on the phones now, try to keep it tight. We're going to get as many phone calls as we can in, and then we will allow all of our panelists to make some final thoughts here. The last 10 minutes are going to fly. So let's go out to Gresham, Oregon. This is Anne first up. Go ahead, Anne.
Hello. Two things. One is I am hearing about stem cell research, and I would like to know more about that in the future from OPB, if possible. And another one is I have fibromyalgia is my primary problem, and I'm 73. I'm reading a book that I picked up at the Multnomah County Library. It's a brand new book, Cannabis for Chronic Pain by Dr. Rav, R-A-V, Ivker, I-V-K-E-R. He is a pain specialist in Colorado, I believe. At any rate, he has written this book that clearly identifies different formulations of cannabis that seem to have best results for different conditions and some of the various modalities for applying it topically or taking a tincture, which would be drops on your tongue. I think many people would find that at least interesting to consider.
All right, and thank you for that. Let me turn to Dr. Alicia Moreland-Capuya. How often are we seeing cannabis used in Oregon?
It is quite frequently something that comes into clinic, and I can tell you that it's complicated. And so I am a board certified addiction psychiatrist, and so I'm working with populations of folks who have both a mental health diagnosis but also an addiction. And what I can tell you with the populations that I serve is that the cannabis discussion complicates things because of its propensity or proclivity to actually increase and or exacerbate depressive states and anxiety in some cases. And so, again, what I would caution us of is every patient and every circumstance is different, and it has to be viewed from that particular lens. And I think there's still a lot that we've yet to discover about cannabis and its overall benefits and its overall long-term sequelae of it on both the psyche and overall physical health. So I just want to kind of caution us to really, it's something that should be talked about and done in consultation with a professional, especially when there are other sort of pre-existing conditions that are being treated. It's complicated.
All right, let's go to Cleveland. This is Jeff next on the phone. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yes. I'm a rheumatologist times 40 years. I believe the pendulum is swinging too far in the wrong direction. My experience with opioids in patients with chronic arthritic conditions supports the notion.
Oh, Jeff, boy, we lost you. And I can tell you that Jeff told our producer before he got through that there's an underappreciation of the benefits for opioids for a select group of patients, and there's a place for chronic opioid therapy, especially for people with rheumatoid arthritis. Dr. Barnett in Cleveland, do you agree with that?
I think that the key thing to remember is at any given moment we can treat pain, but it's a window in time, and there's a very slippery slope involved in this. Does that mean yesterday or tomorrow I can't treat it? No, it does not. But you do build a tolerance with these medications, and not only do you build a tolerance to the pain relieving component, but you also build a tolerance to the reward pathway. And so you've got two self-perpetuating things that are stimulating you to get more of this medication with a decrease in time of the overall benefit. And so it becomes a very, very challenging problem to address. And that's one of the reasons I think that increasing research as well as increasing alternative modalities becomes so important.
All right, let's go to Vancouver, Washington. Heather, next on the phone. Go ahead, Heather.
So hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am very interested in getting I'm curious as to why methadone hasn't been mentioned. Coming from a very personal experience, my father, very high-functioning, you know, high-achieving individual, raised his four kids, and then his back crumbled, four surgeries 10 years later, drug-addicted and consumed by pain. I say Kaiser saved his life when they put him on methadone.
And it has been incredible. You can't even tell he's on medication. He takes about 130, I think his dose is 130 milligrams a day. He's been on it for 10 years now, actually.
And let me just jump in, Heather, because we're going to lose time here. Dr. Wiegand, how often are we hearing methadone, and how do you view that as an option on the menu here?
Well, methadone certainly has saved people's lives, whether it's through the opiate treatment programs, which were the first way of providing opioid agonist therapy to treat opioid addiction. The group of patients that entered methadone clinics survived. They reengaged with families. They did much better than patients that weren't put on methadone. For pain, there are some nuances with methadone that make it a little bit more, well, not just a little bit more, but a much more challenging opioid to work with, in particular if you start with it. The pharmacology is such that it can increase in levels and concentrations and very quickly cause respiratory depression. It has some cardiac effects. At the same time, there's some nuances with the pharmacology that may result in less tolerance and make it a better opioid for certain types of pain, particularly neuropathic pain. So just like anything, it's not one size fits all. The appropriate medication with the appropriate patient, and I think you can have good outcomes. For addiction treatment, it's one thing and saves lives. It's hard to treat patients in an opiate treatment program on methadone for pain at the same time, but it can be done. The focus is to treat the opioid use disorder, not pain, but it can be done. And I think methadone is one of the options.
I've got 90 seconds left here. Dr. Wiegand, do you disagree with perhaps Dr. Barnett or anybody who said we're heading for less opioid prescribing in the future, and that's a good thing? Do you disagree at all with that?
No, I think that's a good thing. We know that the more opioids out there, the more adverse effects, including fatal overdoses. We are dealing with the fallout, including the heroin and now fentanyl epidemic. I think, again, it's the careful prescribing with a goal and reassessment to look at functionality and the right medication with the right patient.
All right. Dr. Barnett, 30 seconds. Final thoughts from you on where we go next with opioid prescription and treatment.
Absolutely. I think the key thing is research. JAMA just published the article that I referenced earlier. We need to continue rolling this out. We need to find out where exactly is it for opiate use? And if there's not a place, what can we do for these patients? Because it's a very real patient population, and we have to address it.
And Dr. Moreland Capuria, 15 seconds, final thoughts, go ahead.
Yes, I do believe that the opioid use disorders is certainly important. However, I would like us to think about the broader discussion of addiction in America and what that entails.
Yeah, that is its whole other discussion. And I want to thank all of the doctors who've taken the time to be in our three studios at OPB in Portland, Oregon, Public Broadcasting, IdeaStream Cleveland, WXXI in Rochester. Our thanks to the patients for sharing their story, Laura Garrison and Michelle Maricos, and to all of the callers and the wonderful team behind this broadcast and head producer Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful afternoon.